Hi everyone, and welcome to the Tom Raftery IT.net podcast. My guest on today's podcast is Shel Israel. Shel, first off, thanks a million for agreeing to do this podcast.
It's a pleasure to be asked, Tom. Thank you.
Great. Shel, for anyone who doesn't know him, describes himself as a recovering publicist. Shel is the former owner of a PR company specializing in tech startups, and as such, Shel was involved in the initial launches of Sun Microsystems, PowerPoint, FileMaker, SoundBlaster, Napster, etc., etc., and quite a few others. And most recently, Shel co-authored Naked Conversations. Naked Conversations is the book on business blogging, and Shel co-authored it with Robert Scoble of Microsoft, who we did a podcast with last week. Robert's coming to Cork, Ireland, here on the 30th of November to speak at IT at Cork's annual conference. I got to get that plug in. Shel, you've told me many times that you yourself would like to come to Ireland. First off, to steer away from IT and stuff like that for a second, what is it about Ireland that appeals to you?
Oh, a great deal appeals to me about Ireland. My best friend, who died a couple of years back, but he and I were extremely close for 35 years, is first-generation American. He is from County Cork, actually,
okay.
And he started to get me in love with it. When I was in college, he kind of pulled me away from my Jewish immigrant roots and brought me into Boston Irish culture, where I learned the wisdom of taverns and the clandestine fundraising that goes on in the back rooms there. I'm still a lousy darts player without at least 5 pints in me, though.
Wow, great. Well, hopefully you'll be able to make it over soon and see our... Well, we think it's a beautiful country. Hopefully we'll have you over here shortly.
I think it's a beautiful country, too. I just want to see it live and in color.
Great. Shel, yourself and Robert wrote Naked Conversations right out there in the open. As you completed each chapter of the book, and even as you did interviews with the people for the book, you published those online. What was it like writing a book as transparently as you guys did with Naked Conversations?
That's a great question. I haven't been asked that one before. At first, it was really scary.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you were around at the beginning, but Robert asked me to think about doing it transparently on a blog.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, let's test the waters and we'll talk about it. And he took that as an overwhelming yes and posted that we were doing it, posted the financial agreements between us, and that's how I got my commitment.
Right.
As time went on, I discovered his wisdom. When this project began, the earliest stuff that we wrote was received with what we call tough love in the blogosphere. In other words, people hated it. And I was forced to really listen to what was being said, and in so doing, I started understanding that I was being too much of a recovering publicist and cheerleading it. The blogosphere made me become what I think I became, which was a reporter of what was going on. They gave us, over time, some of our best case studies. They made each chapter much, much better. Basically, we collaborated with anybody who wanted to drop by Naked Conversations online and tell us what they liked or didn't like about it. Secondly, we did something that other writer wannabes should take note of. We got 5 publishers interested in us, and eventually we got a bidding war, which didn't hurt us at all.
Sure.
in securing Wiley. And third is, and this is probably what we're most excited about, we didn't mean it this way, but we discovered that a blog can be a tremendous marketing mechanism for something starting up.
Sure.
In our case, it was a book, but we have a great deal of recognition on a global level, which two guys working by phone and email on a book probably would not have gotten.
Yeah, absolutely. It's it has received an amazing amount of publicity before it's even launched at all, just through the fact that it's been on the blog and people have been talking about it.
It has, and we're very gratified. And now we get to the crucial question of, will the bloggers buy the book?
That's always a tricky one, isn't it? Because to all intents and purposes, most people have read it already.
Well, they've read earlier chapters, earlier versions of the chapters.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that thrilled us by surprise is in watching our registers and our links is that what people seemed to like was everything but the chapters. People don't really enjoy reading 8,000 to 10,000 word excerpts on a computer.
Yeah.
And that should be good news to publishers. It means that books will be around for a while, and I'm happy about it.
Great. If you were writing another book, Shell, would you do it online again?
I have started writing another book, and yes, I will do it online once we get past all the noise that's going on right now with Naked Conversations.
Right. Great. Great. That's a ringing endorsement of the methodology.
I'm going to. Robert won't be involved in the next book, but
sure.
I am very much into the collaboration with people out there. It's been said by a great number of people, but this is the wisdom of crowds. The blogosphere is collectively smarter than any one person who writes on it.
Yeah,
and that's very valuable to me.
Yeah, can't argue with that. Shell. We have a situation here in Ireland where we've got still very few Irish companies not yet blogging. A question I asked Robert, and I'm going to put the same question to you, is why do you think a company should have a blog?
Do you want the 3-hour, 5-hour, 7-hour answer to this one? First of all, I wouldn't be too disheartened that there aren't too many business bloggers in Ireland yet. I think the work you're doing alone, Tom, is going to get others to do it. You're a very good blogger. But secondly, it's all just begun. I've been blogging 2 years. Robert's only been blogging 3.5 years. And if there are 21 million bloggers now, I can't give you a 1-year number, but 18 months ago there were 4 million. So the thing is just getting going, and businesses, particularly the enterprise, are among the latest to adopt any new technology.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would you like me to keep going on this,
Let's just push it a small bit further.
Yeah.
What would you see as, say, the advantages of blogging to a business?
Okay. Pardon the long pause on the air.
Yeah.
The essential difference is from what I call a broadcast, what many people call a broadcast marketing form, to a conversational form, and this is in a lot of ways retro. 50 years ago, we all had local merchants. It may be different in Ireland. I'm a little ignorant in this area, but they depended for the most part on the customers they had getting them their next level of customers. And this was terrific. It meant that the marketplace, more than marketing, determined who was going to be good mouthed, how word of mouth would make a company flourish. We went through a 50-year period where broadcast marketing came in to support neighborhood stores that were now part of chains and franchises and superstores. God, I hope you don't suffer with Home Depot's over there yet, and I hope you never have to, but Americans are now shopping in these 35,000 square foot stores that look alike as they dot our landscape.
You'll be happy to hear we've just passed legislation to allow those companies to do the same here.
You have my deepest sympathy. You really do. But let's keep my anti-capitalist strains aside for a moment. What happened, though, is when you have chains and franchises, or whether you're a global corporation, if you're Intel or Hewlett-Packard, you can't talk to every customer anymore. So you start pushing messages. You do it with advertising. You do it with PR, corporate brochures, websites. You make sure everybody is trained so that whoever you ask a question, you get the same answer, perhaps word for word. And really hate it. People really hate it. They don't need this sense of an infallible, robot-like corporate organization. They just want to talk to real people who are doing real jobs. And what blogging does and what evolving social media do, it is that they make the conversation scale. They make two neighbors talking over a backyard fence a worldwide phenomenon. They do it very cheaply.
Sure.
And I'm sorry for the long-winded answer.
No, it's good. It's always good to consider answers. For companies who are starting out in blogging, what advice would you give them to be successful in blogging?
Yeah, read my book would be a good clear answer. In a lot of ways, that is what the book is about. But begin by listening. I consult startups on the issue of a blog-based strategy that eliminates PR and other parts of marketing. And I tell them to do nothing but go read other blogs. Don't even look for blogs in your category. Just find blogs that you like and look at the language that's being used. Then start learning how to use the tools such as Technorati and PubSub so that you can start finding conversations that are germane to your business.
Uh-huh.
Everybody, when they start blogging, even Robert Scoble, I'm sure, begins gingerly. It's a scary thing. You put your words out there, and somebody can drop an ugly comment on you. They can say negative things about you. You have to kind of get in ankle deep and see what it's like and learn that polite criticism posted on your blog is not necessarily a bad thing. If you listen to it, you start improving who you are and you start understanding why some of your potential customers and prospects and partners may be slightly unhappy with you. If it's unjustified, other bloggers will join in and defend you. You can just sit there and watch. Another thing that happens when you start is you worry about what will I say. And every new blogger I know worries about this. In about a month or two, the problem is they don't feel like they have time to say all the things that are coming into their mind. This is not monolithic, and corporations have a great deal of trouble understanding this is interactive, that you need to start joining other people's conversations and getting those people to look at who you are and come in. Then the third thing to realize is that you just need to let go of control. You need to trust the people who work for you to say things that are true about your company that other people will believe.
Right. One barrier that I've heard raised by companies is they're afraid of comments. They're afraid of allowing comments because they're afraid what people will say about them, and they're also afraid in blogging itself. They're afraid to talk about strategies that they might use going forward, because, and this is a phrase I've heard, because what if our competitors are reading the blog?
Well,
so there's two things there. There's fear of being open in blogging and fear of getting comments.
Well, both of those are legitimate fears. To the latter, I would say, I would hope your competitors are reading your blog, because that's where you begin becoming a leader, particularly a thought leader, is when you start writing things that are good. Two is, the people in your company who are blogging are people who really understand already what they can't talk about at social gatherings and the pub on a Friday night, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
And when they go onto the blog, they have to have a certain sensitivity about what your corporate secrets are and what should not be discussed. If you start blogging, you should have a whole lot of people involved in discussing it. The lawyers, of course, will say absolutely nothing. The PR people will say, tweak it up. But once you have a consensus of what's online, what's fair game on a blog and what's not fair game, then you're ready to blog. And then once you're ready to blog, I advise every blogger I know to break the rules. Want me to explain that a little?
Two, please.
It's Robert, I don't know if he talked about this with you, says in a corporation there is no line to cross. It's much more like a membrane. It's something that you stretch. And if you stretch it too far, the membrane of that corporation will snap back on you, sort of like a slingshot.
Right.
If you don't test the membrane, if you always play it safe, you will suffer one of the greatest sins you can suffer as a blogger. You will be boring.
Uh-huh.
And you will do a company no good if you're represented in a blog in a boring sort of manner.
True enough. Great. Moving on.
Yes.
On my own blog, I've written posts about the likes of Memorandum, Flock, Yahoo Maps, Start.com, all these various applications. These posts were read and had comments left on them by the developers of these applications. Now, I find that infinitely fascinating. But turning it around, as a developer of an application, or if I'm in a company who's developing an application, how do I go about seeing what people are saying about my application or my product?
If I understand you right, that's fairly easy. You can use the tool I use for that sort of thing is PubSub, which is, like many of the blogging tools, a little difficult to understand when you first get there. But when you do, you can, in a relatively short period of time, figure out how any topic, including your own name or your own software, can be followed. And using an RSS feed such as you get from NewsGator, you can have it home delivered to your computer, perhaps in your email like I do it with NewsGator, so that if anybody says anything on a topic that's interesting to you, you will get it almost instantly. You will know about it sometimes in minutes, certainly no more than a few hours.
Great. Yep, that's exactly it. That's the kind of thing I'm telling companies as well. I obviously we do searches for what people are saying about ourselves, but also the fact that companies can do searches for their own products and see what people are saying about them online is revolutionary for companies, not just for their own products, but also for, say, their competitors' products. It becomes an incredible tool in marketing intelligence.
Its powers are still being underestimated for market intelligence and for business intelligence. Because of RSS, you can know when anybody, including your competitors and your prospects and your customers, updates anything in a matter of minutes. You used to have to go from website to website to website, and then you had to read page after page after page to discover a single paragraph got changed. Now you get it delivered to you in the course of your business day. You can respond to it much faster than before, orders of magnitude than before. People talk a fair amount about the crises that bloggers have caused. What is much more interesting is the number that they've prevented, because companies that are listening to the blogosphere, even if they're not blogging themselves, can jump in and correct any misinformation being distributed about their company very, very quickly.
Sure.
And you can stop the famous kryptonite situation from occurring.
And of course, if you have the blog on your own site, you then start to control the conversation.
Absolutely. I had a client a few days ago, its name is Rhea, and a rumor began that Google had purchased it. And I was busy doing some other work that day, and the client was actually traveling that day. And by the time we understood what happened, there were 3,200 posts, according to Technorati, on Rhea being acquired by Google. At 10 o'clock that night, I posted that this was not true, and I placed comments on 6 to 10, I didn't try for the 3,200, 6 to 10 blogs that I thought were more prominent.
Right.
And I simply said, this is not true. By morning it was gone. And that was stopped. There was an article in the online publication called The Register that accused Microsoft in its IE7 beta version of intentionally disabling software from Google and Yahoo. This was absolutely untrue, but for Microsoft, this was an immediate crisis because it implied they were violating their settlement of antitrust issues. Scoble got on the internet at about 10 o'clock that night and started discounting what was said. And what was interesting is by Monday, nothing was happening. Nobody else was talking about Microsoft and antitrust. Nobody was running down the U.S. Justice Department hallways telling a superior that it was time to go after Microsoft again. The whole thing was forgotten. Day after day after day, crises are averted because people are listening to the blogosphere and using their own blogs as vehicles to speak out when they need to.
Brilliant. Yeah. So we can see straight away the blogs and RSS, the kind of plumbing that goes underneath blogs, is of tremendous value to companies. Do you see any benefits to companies for things like podcasts and videocasts?
Oh, yeah. You keep giving me a chance to plug Robert, but the original corporate video blog is Channel 9, which Robert is the primary news, the only newscaster. You never see him. You hear his voice. You hear an occasional "oh crap" when he bangs into a wall while toting the camera. But what he's doing is he's going around from chief developer to chief developer in product after product at Microsoft, and he's showing outsiders who want to see, which is now millions of outsiders, that Microsoft is not just made up of the icons of Ballmer and Gates. It's made up of an awful lot of people who are very passionate about technology, who are trying to deliver new products and new services to the public,
sure.
and who are listening to the commentary that's coming in from those from that same audience, which is overwhelmingly technical.
I can see how Channel 9 has done tremendous things, no doubt about it, for Microsoft Image. I mean,
made history.
Yeah, Microsoft Image was pretty poor, and it has come a long way in the short time that Channel 9 has been running.
Mm-hmm.
For smaller companies, for companies who haven't the kind of massive scale and size that Microsoft have, for say companies with, you know, 250, 500 employees, how would you see a podcast or a videocast to be of use to them?
Well, first of all, as you know, as a new podcaster, the barriers to entry in terms of either technology or cost are very, very low.
Sure.
And what you can do is let people see and hear what's going on inside your company, and you're doing it in a way that isn't trying to dupe them with the famous free registration trick, which we all know about. If I just give you my name and email, you will then send me email I don't want for the rest of my natural life. But with podcasts and with videocasts, you can take me inside your company. You can let me meet your players. You can let me see how they work. You can let me, with an accompanying blog, comment on what I've seen and ask you for what I want to see more of. The popularity of particularly podcasts, I need to differentiate a bit between podcast and video. Video has a few barriers that still need to be worked out. I think there are 18 video standards in all. There are probably four or five that are very popular, and therefore you need to be in sync with your target audience that you're allowing them to view it on whatever they're using, and that's a little more complicated.
Sure.
Podcast is different. You need an audience that either commute so that they have a time to listen, or jog so that they have time to listen, or are interested enough to sit at their computers and listen. But all of these new social media are trying the same thing. They're trying to show real people inside a company who have greater dedication than the robots we envision when we read the corporate brochure. And they're trying to create vehicles in which the customers, not just the customers, but the entire corporate constituency is capable of responding.
So basically, podcasts, videocasts, blogs, they're all about humanizing a company.
Humanization is probably one of the most essential words to what this is all about. Do we have time for me to give one of my old stories?
Please do.
Okay. In the middle 90s, for a brief, unfortunate period, I worked for a very large PR agency called Ketchum Communications, who you might have heard of.
Yep.
And one of my clients then, most of my career has been startups, but I decided to go for the big time for a brief period. And one of my clients was MCI, which at that time had a campaign, I don't know if they had it in Ireland, but it was called Family and Friends. We had Whoopi Goldberg on TV touting it. It was part of what the marketers call an integrated marketing campaign that resulted in people, at least in the States, being called between 6 and 8 p.m. during dinner and being offered to join this new Family and Friends phone service. And I wasn't involved in that part of it, but in working with MCI, I took the chance with with my client who was in charge of Family and Friends, and over it's American and not Irish, so we were drinking white wine and not Guinness. But I, after he had three and I had one, I said, you know, people really hate this. They really, really hate you calling them over and over again. I switched MCI because you're my client, and you're still calling me, and I can't stop it. And he looked at me and said, I couldn't care less. We are getting better than 2% in every major metro area in the United States. In some places we have 4.5%. And if the other, I'm cleaning up the language a little for our audio listeners, the other 98% of the people, they do business with my competitor. I could care less about them. And that has become the direct marketing anthem. That it's efficient right now to blast out a message all over the place, and if you get 2% response, you make a profit off of it. And if you annoy the other 98%, you don't care. Well, the problem is that most of the time, you and I and everybody listening right now happen to be part of the 98%. Mm-hmm. We really hate this stuff. We fight back with interesting devices. We use our brains to filter out as many marketing messages we possibly can. If I have a TiVo so that I can fast forward and avoid all TV commercials while I'm watching, which is really a pleasure. I have a spam guard, and I assume you do too. Yeah. And we keep, it's like a Cold War. We keep finding ways to block the messages, and they keep finding ways to send the messages. And this has created a global anti-corporate, certainly anti-corp speak mentality. You couple that with some of America's shoddiest corporate behavior in the last 5 years, and you have a great deal of untrust. So the thought is, if you humanize it, if you show authentic people who are passionate and know about parts of the company, and you let them speak with audiences out there, you have what you called a moment ago the humanization factor coming in. You start seeing real people doing real jobs, and you start realizing that somewhere along the line there became a common wisdom that marketing should be this pound of crap that nobody's going to believe, but if you keep saying it often enough, people are going to remember. It doesn't work anymore. Sorry for the soapbox.
No. It's good. It's all good. Changing tack again slightly. You've recently blogged that you're going to start writing about startups. What aspect of startups most interests you?
Oh, God. I've spent my life working with startups. I am interested in innovation and disruption. I think that technologies change, but there is a certain spirit which exists in certain people that says, I'm not going to join a large corporation. I'm going to do something new. I'm going to do it better. And in either a small or large degree, I'm going to change the world. And that's where my personal passion really lies.
Working with people like that.
Yeah. Yeah. My client for the last 25 years has been roughly 25 to 30 years old, has been on an early round of venture capital, was in a hurry, was a shade arrogant, had a team built around a bunch of technologists who, until developers became fashionable in the last couple of years, were kind of hidden in the back room, but everything else was built around them. I love those guys in the back room with the mustard on their sleeves who are pounding out code and trying to change the world. And what I love is some of these MBAs in short pants, as somebody once called them once, actually have changed the world. And what's been interesting is I'm 25 years older, but my client's still the same age. There seems to be a little notch where people do these things, and I just love it. I think that's where the excitement is.
Great. What what challenges do startups face today that they didn't 25 years ago?
A great many challenges have changed. And they seem to play off of what Bill Gates said a few weeks ago. There seems to be a major change every 5 years. 5 years ago, the dot-com had bubbled up and imploded. And the challenge for a startup then was they couldn't raise money. And if they did raise money, they had oxymoronically venture capitalists who didn't want any risk. We've now entered into a new period where big visions are being encouraged again. Startups can now go to a venture capitalist and say, I have a dream and I have technology, and give me a few million dollars and give me a chance. The real challenge has remained the same over 25 years, and that is to break people's habits, to create something that's so good that stops me from doing what I've done every day. I have managed to hate Microsoft Word for about 25 years now. And taking it away from me, you would have to come up with a pretty incredible piece of software, or a web service as it is now, to stop me from doing what I've always done. Rhea, who I'm in love with right now, they're my most recent startup success.
Mm-hmm.
Developed some recognition photography so that if I tell Rhea that this is a picture of you, Tom, then every picture in Rhea or on your desktop or on my desktop of you is now recognized. If I tell Rhea that this is Las Vegas, it will recognize all photos of Las Vegas. This is the kind of excitement I like, because the frustration of digital photography is the fact that we have all this crap building up in our computers and on our services, and we can't find what we want. We're still not sending our pictures to our mothers-in-law. So I just like the fire in the eye, the dream, the refusal to recognize that you can possibly fail, and I like going for it. I like the sense of urgency. So I guess I like a whole lot about startups.
Sounds great. Sounds great. One last thing. I put a post on my own blog today asking if any of my readers had any questions that they'd like me to ask you.
I should have peeked.
I got one from Brian Green. Do you mind taking it?
Mm-hmm.
Brian asks, he says, there are 40,000 blogs updated every hour of the day. 40,000 blog updates every hour of the day. How am I supposed to read that? And then he goes on, seriously, hasn't blogging just added to the textual data smog that makes it easier for governments to bury the truth, making facts harder to come by?
I don't think so. First, I'm not sure that there are 40,000 blogs being updated every hour. Did he say every hour?
I may have read that wrong. I think he said there are 40,000 blog updates every hour.
According to PubSub, there's about 20 million blogs, and only 2% of them on the average are updated every day.
Sure.
So there's a whole mess of blogs being updated. What is relevant, going back to an earlier part of our talk, is it's very easy to find the few of them that would be of interest to you in your work or your personal life.
Yeah.
And you don't have to randomly look at everything. You really get, I call it the my news factor. You know, Mimi Rand random. I'm not quite sure where it's going, but I see the day when they can give me the traditional and blogged news on any subject in any kind of balance that I want or you want or anyone else wants. So I don't see that problem. And the problem about government is a whole other subject, but I don't really see any comparisons between the volume of government data output and the type of news, opinion, and debate that we're finding on the blogosphere every day. Do you?
I don't. I don't know what Brian was trying to get at. Possibly it was that if an issue comes up that concerns government, any government, there are going to be 15, 20, 30, 40, 100 bloggers maybe jump on that issue, blog about it, and maybe that's the kind of textual data smog that Brian is referring to in his question. Suddenly you have 100 different posts or opinions out there about something that's happened, and it's easier for the government to maybe lie low or leak something to a particular media source, or I don't know, and get the facts buried underneath all the crosstalk.
Well, theoretically that could happen, I guess, but I follow some bloggers very closely. They are the bloggers I trust.
Uh-huh.
For example, if Doc Searle says it, I believe it is true.
Right.
If David Weinberger says it, I believe that it is true, but he sometimes has a caffeinated personality when it comes on to politics, and I factor that in, and I can do that because I know him as a reader of his blog. So if you start trying to game the system by getting all this stuff out in 100 places, I'm going to see who you are. I'm going to click on PubSub and find out how many people read you. If you've made an important contention, I'm going to read a whole bunch of your other blogs and see whether I believe you or not. What is really nice to me about the blogosphere is we all pick who we can trust, and we can find out a great deal about them using the tools in a matter of minutes.
Yeah. It's a far more transparent world now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's there are words I keep trying to avoid in this conversation, such as passion, transparent, humanity, the words that all us blogging zealots keep using, but those words mean something, and even though they're used a great deal, it's what it's all about.
Yeah, absolutely. Shell, that's it. That's all the questions I have. And I think we've done our time.
Thank God, it's all the answers I have.
Shell, thanks a million for doing the podcast for me. It's been really, really interesting. I hope the listenership will find it interesting as well.
Thank you,
Tom. I'll see you in Paris on the 5th.
Oh, we'll always have Paris. I can't wait.